Welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast.
Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Because we're on a mission. Listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction.
With Lisa Hyten, Sophie Bryan, Gary Spinks, and myself, Ray Campion.
It's just so incredible.
This is part one in our recruitment, selection, and onboarding series. We hope you enjoy.
Not a marketing scheme, so it's hard to believe. All of the new energy you're starting to see.
Welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. I am Ray, and today we have a full complement. Say hello, peoples.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, peoples.
Hello, people. So, we've got a topic that we've kind of, for various reasons, sort of kicked the can down the road on this a little for a few weeks. But you know what? We're going to get into it and we're going to do it. And so it's all about recruitment, selection, engagement, and onboarding. So the reason I want to talk about this topic, because I think it's quite apt in the current situation. You know, there's going to be a lot of transformation and change in the jobs market, and a lot of companies are going to be hiring, you know, new startups looking to mobilize themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought it was a good opportunity just to run back on a topic that we had touched on some time ago, but in a little bit more detail, because, you know, there's all sorts of challenges around it at the moment, particularly, you know, a lot of this that we'll talk about is going to be done online. And I've got a couple of specific things I want to ask you all about with regards to online interviewing and that sort of thing. But also, it's probably, as an organization, it's the one of the single biggest investments you will make into your people resources. And we've said before on this podcast that we are, I think, as a collective, a little bit dismayed at how little importance many organizations put into their recruitment, selection, engagement, and onboarding. So in the first instance, we talk about identifying the need. So working in projects, we would generally have an organizational chart. We would have a schedule of roles and responsibilities associated with activities that are in the schedule or program. And so as we're mobilizing our project team to deliver the job, we'd have a very clear series of boxes to fill, if you like. So we'd be going out in a controlled and managed way, he says, laughing, because we don't tend to do it in a controlled and managed way. And we'd be engaging people to fill those roles. I know within other organizations, often it's more a case of a workload thing, whereby maybe a particular department would pick up a lot more work for some reason or have to do some additional tasks and would therefore identify a need to bring in some additional resources. Sophie, I'm interested in your take on this. So you've worked a lot in local authority. How generally are recruitment needs identified within local authorities?
I guess one of the frustrations I see with how they're identified is that they generally tend to replace like for like. And where somebody, you know, we talk a lot about interview bias and the biases that present themselves in the way that we interview. And what I see come up the most is that they want to recruit somebody who was like the previous person.
Okay.
And so therefore, the job description, the person specification, and even the way the recruitment is designed is quite often around, oh, you know, this person was really good at that. We need to make sure we have more of that. And they kind of craft it around trying to find that version, you know, 2.0 of what was there previously. Mm-hmm. And I guess what's frustrating about that is that I don't believe the way we design jobs at the minute anyway is fully effective. I think I've mentioned this before in previous podcasts, where we expect people to have really strong technical skills in a certain area. And particularly if we're looking at management skills, we want them to have people skills as well. And it's very difficult to try and find that balance of the P and the T, the person and the technical. And I think they have a great opportunity when a vacancy arises or a new position is born into the organisation to really think about what does that skills dissect look like? And is there a better way that role could be delivered, which isn't necessarily recruiting the same job that you had before, but looking at, okay, well, maybe if we move this part out to a different part of a role, play to this person's skills, develop these skills, then we can create a whole new role whilst developing somebody else. And I don't think those conversations happen enough, particularly in local authorities that have that I've had the pleasure of working with.
So quite often within LAs, it's more they're filling vacancies that have arisen as opposed to new roles that specifically have been generated because of a new requirement or something.
Okay. I think at the moment as well, Ray, there's a big, most local authorities are really struggling from an income perspective. Local authorities are always very much efficiencies driven. So they're always trying to make cutbacks, but having to deliver more with less money. And I think at the moment, I think what I'm seeing throughout a lot of organisations is they're really scaling back on recruitment. So they will have necessary roles that need to be delivered. They are probably looking at finding where those skills can be delivered in internally, but not a lot of new roles are being created as we speak because, you know, they've got less money to deal with and they've got an even greater agenda on their hands that they need to deliver on. So creating new roles and bringing new people into the organisation is just another, you know, line on the spreadsheet that has to be dealt with in terms of funds.
Interesting you talk about, like, when they're under particular requirements to be efficient, that for a lot of organisations, both public and private sector, sort of the first spotlight that gets shone is on the people. I've read a book recently called The Infinite Game by Simon Sinek.
Yeah.
And he talks about the battle between will and resources. Resources being money, machinery, stuff like that. Will being what people bring to you. And the fact that if people are nurtured properly, there's an unending pool of will, whereas resources are always finite. So it's interesting, you know, and it is like, I understand why it happens because I've seen it. Like most of my work in life, as soon as a bit of pressure comes on, immediately the sort of the natural thing is to look at the people. But that's such a finite, short-term view that actually it's probably quick and easy. It's never easy to get, you know, to make people redundant and stuff. But in terms of the things that an organization has to do, it's probably the path of least resistance, which is not necessarily to say that it's the correct path, but anyway. Okay. So we've identified we need to recruit somebody. So the next bullet point I've got is we need to specify the role requirements. Now, this kind of comes back to what you were just saying there, Sophie, about we have a list of technical requirements, but how many organizations have a list of non-technical requirements? In construction, in railway signaling, we talk about functional and non-functional requirements. So functional is what it needs to do, and non-functional is more about how it needs to do it and how it looks like when it's doing it. And I wonder if we spend enough time actually sitting down and figuring out what is it that we actually want this person to do, and possibly more importantly, how do we want this person to be in the role? Because that'll probably have a bigger implication on their ability to perform said role than their ability technically to do the role, if you catch them adrift.
There's a big issue that I see consistently, and that is around the roles of values and behaviours in recruitment and how embedded values and behaviours are in the culture of the organisation. And in a recruitment perspective, I feel like there should be a much greater weighting on exploring people's values and behaviours than what you should be on the skill. So, there's the saying that you recruit for attitude, train for skill. And I think that's absolutely right, because you need to think about recruitment as being, you're opening up the gates to your organisation to the outside. You are letting people into your organisation. once you let in the wrong person, it's incredibly difficult to get that person out. So I'm talking from the perspective of dealing with disciplinaries, with grievances, with capability, with sickness absence that's come from capability. You know, the whole gambit. I mean, I was talking to a HR director the other week, and I was saying that, you know, in terms of employee relations cases, you very rarely just get somebody who you think, okay, this is a capability issue, we need to work with them, upskill them, things aren't working, okay, let's put them into a performance improvement plan and eventually exit them from the organisation. Very rarely does it work like that. It will end up then being about that person's then gone off sick with stress because they're being managed. Or they may raise a grievance about the fact they feel they're being bullied by their manager because they're being managed. Whether that's right or wrong is completely irrelevant. And, you know, the merits of that, I've seen it, you know, both ways where there has been genuine cases for that. But you think in a recruitment process, that is the potential consequences of you bringing in the wrong person. And there is always such a huge investment of time, money, effort, HR teams that are built to help get people out of the organisation. When you've somehow ended up with the wrong kind of person in your business and they do not invest that in the recruitment process, how much more effective and more added value would you get from taking the amount of effort that goes into exiting someone from a business and the risk and put that into getting the right people with the right attitude and behaviours in the business? You know, the results speak for themselves, you know. The recruitment process is a gatekeeping process, and it just takes that one inappropriate recruit that may have the most amazing skills on paper, may even have the most amazing skills in practice, but treats the team like rubbish, doesn't communicate, isn't forthcoming with information, no gossips. You know, these people create toxic environments, and if you haven't spent the time at the recruitment process exploring that, you have no idea what you're letting into your organization.
Yeah. And I would say as well that, like, it's not always necessarily that there's it. Sometimes it's not even a case of right, wrong, or indifferent. It's that somebody could be very technically capable. They're a wonderful person. They're quite well motivated, but for whatever reason, culturally, they just don't fit the organization or the team. And that's not to say anything bad about them as an individual, because they go into a different scenario and it's like, you know, they fit in perfectly. It is very, very nuanced. And this is why I think sometimes it ends up as such a, people are almost afraid of it, because it's so easy to get it wrong. And it's like, okay, so there's too much nuance here in searching for the right character. So therefore we'll just go for the right technical and hope to crikey that they fit into the culture. Because let's face it, lots of hiring managers actually don't really even understand what the culture of their team or organization is. And if culture isn't important in the organization, why would they? If culture is important in the organization, then the first and foremost remit of the gatekeepers in the recruitment and selection process is to maintain and ensure that new hires are complementing that culture, as opposed to going to run up against it. And, you know, we're not going to sort of bash people here for like getting it wrong. We've probably all got it wrong at times, or we've been the person who got hired into the wrong culture. And I've certainly got an example of that from my experience of where I ended up getting recruited into an organization. And to this day, I can never figure out why, because I was completely, and they knew me personally, but I was just completely the wrong person for the role and for the type of person they were looking to fill that role. Unfortunately, we didn't both discover it until I was in the role. And 6 months later, I left because it was never going to be a long-term thing. We just weren't going to fit. I was a square peg and it was a very round hole. So in terms of like specifying the requirements of the role, experiences from or anecdotes from your experience with regards to when it's happened right, when it's happened wrong, have either of you two been on the end of that stick where it has ended up wrong? What's your experience been?
Oh, I'm trying to think. I've been quite lucky, I think, in my history of interviews, and there haven't been many. I went for a lot of years without having, not having to apply for jobs because I worked for myself. And I'd been with the same organisation before that.
Have you ever been a hiring manager, Lisa?
I've been involved in the process, yeah. I think if I ever leave this job, that'll be down to me as well to kind of find my replacement. I'd be involved in that to a certain point. But, yeah, when I worked at the college years ago, I got involved quite a lot recruiting for our team. A lot of the process was the same across the board. It didn't matter which department, which team you were recruiting for. The scales were the same across the board. So the pay scales were the same. The job descriptions and stuff were quite generic. And our manager at the time would have an input into what that is. And the last manager I worked under was actually even better, because as a team, he would get us together to write or have our own input into that job description. But actually for us, we were really keen that it was about the person and not necessarily having all the skills and ticking all the boxes. It was much more about what they were like, because we were quite a small team of about 5 or 6. So anyone coming into that could completely change the dynamics of the team. So we were much more about the people rather than necessarily worrying that they had absolutely everything on the list. And even more so when I followed on from there, I worked for a family business. So they'd started off as husband and wife, mum and dad, and then they slowly took on people from outside of the family to build the business. And I think even then it was even more key, because none of them had had any experience in hiring staff before. They'd all worked for other people. So they were suddenly stepping up into becoming employers. And actually, I started off with them just helping them out for nothing, because I was waiting to start uni. And yeah, so I never really had an interview with them. I just kind of started and didn't leave for 6 years, and sort of developed job roles for myself within the business. And So it wasn't until this job, which was only in September, I had my interview. And that was probably the first interview I'd had in about 11 years. So it was a long gap.
See, for me, this specifying the requirements and actually writing up the role profile, job description, whatever you want to call it, is actually, this is where a lot in my experience where I've gone wrong, or organizations I've worked with have gone wrong, because you and it does flow down into then how that role gets advertised and how it appears to prospective applicants and stuff. It's very much, we kind of go for the easy wins. So we might know, like coming from my industry, you know, we're very clear about what the technical requirements for a specific role are. And so we're like, well, we don't have to put too much thought into that, so we'll put those up there first. So, you know, must be able to blah, must have 5 years experience in blah, 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 blah. And that's very easy. And then we kind of forget about the fact that we're actually employing a human being. And probably what we want to do first is we want to appeal to the human, because as we've just talked about, if we get that bit wrong, that's when it all starts to go a bit pear-shaped. So, like until relatively recently, I hadn't realized just how blah role profiles and job descriptions are. And I've found as an external consultant, often when you're recruiting within an organization, a client organization, you have to use their role profiles. And unfortunately, they're not very good. Because it's kind of written from the head down as opposed to the heart up. So it's all about, you know, you'll have this amount of experience, you'll have this sort of qualification, et cetera, all important and good stuff. You don't want to be recruiting a brain surgeon who's, you know, only ever done car mechanics before. Not that I get involved in recruiting brain surgeons, so relax, peeps. But, you know, the principle is the same. However, it's not just about that. You can get to the technical, and yes, you can use the technical to start shortlisting some of your people, but what you really want to be trying to appeal to is the human. So you've got to start with some things that are going to engage people, and that tends to be not as everybody would think, oh, you know, what's the salary going to be? What's the holidays going to be like? Do I get a company car? What sort of band of car is it? Am I going to end up driving a Yaris, or do I get a Mercedes? You know, people aren't actually titillated by that sort of thing. What they're titillated often by is more to do with culture and dynamics and that sort of thing. So do we spend enough time when we're drawing up the role requirements actually sitting down and thinking, this is the culture of our organization, and we actually want to design our role requirements so that they fit in with that. And I'm not talking about generic sort of nouns like, you know, driven and engaged and, you know, all that sort of nonsense, because they're just words. But actually putting a bit of creative thought into how do we write this thing. And let's for the purposes of this discussion, let's join up then, writing the role requirements and the job description into creating the ad, you know, how do we go about then getting that message out there to say, we have a role, this is the sort of person, blah, blah, blah. And I'm hoping this is where Gary and Lisa with their marketing are going to jump in here and give me a bit of help and guidance and support. How do we creatively write a specification that flows great well into an ad, whether it is that we advertise it ourselves or go through an agent, in order to engage the market? Gary Spinks, can we start with you?
You can always start with me, right?
As the creative writer amongst us, give our listeners some guidance here. What do they need to be thinking about?
So I think it's partly depend on the type of organisation you are, because we've already talked earlier about the importance of, I think from our point of view, having a culture and having values. So I think if you are an organisation that is, you know, basing how you operate on that, I think you're going to be having a head start against those companies and organizations that do not, because I think you can then recruit for the cultural and the attitude fit, rather than just go down the strict, you know, skills and ticking off the tech checklist, as it were. So I think very much you want to have that balance. Is what does this, you know, a little bit like you said, you know, there's function. So what does this role require the person to do, but also what type of person do we want to have in that role? And I think it's getting a balance of that.
Would you, Gary, would you advise as an avid storyteller, and I resonate with that with you as well. Would you advise, or would you endorse almost telling a story? Do we need to more engage with people in terms of telling a story? So maybe the first part of the role requirement and the ad needs to be a little anecdote about the organization that gives that sense of, this is what the culture of the organization is, and this is what we will do for you on the basis of using our TA mantra of, I'm okay, you're okay. So I'm guessing you're coming to my organization for this job with the best of intentions. And therefore I want to, in the first instance, by means of expressing a little story about the organization, give you some direction in terms of what my organization's culture is about and what we will do for you outside of the, this will be your salary, these will be your benefits kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, I would certainly say, having looked at, you know, for research and other projects, you know, many hundreds, probably thousands of, you know, job adverts in different industries and fields. And there's a, you know, you get to see the same kind of language. It's almost like there's a template where people have got, you know, copy and paste Oh, we used that last time. Yeah, that's good. And it just becomes a meaningless list of, as you say, things like we want people who are motivated, driven. You know, we're in a fast-paced environment and all this kind of stuff, which is just becomes meaningless. So if you can actually turn it and actually, because what you're talking to, your advert is talking to one person at a time, that person that's looking for a job. So if you want to appeal to them, then you want to be looking at, well, what are they looking out of the job and the role and your organization? And that so the whole story, the picture that you paint is around that. You know, if you're someone who is looking for, you can either say, you know, we could be a good fit, or you could say, if you're the certain type of person who's looking for X, Y, and Z, we're probably not going to be a good fit because we're A, B, and Z. So you can also frame it that way. But I do think it's being a bit more human about it. I know there's probably some, you know, legal stuff behind, you know, we have to say certain things, but, you know, just make it a little bit more interesting. I mean, there's just too many where you look at it and you just think there's absolutely nothing different from this compared to somebody else. Anybody could say, if you've got an ad and somebody could read and say, well, anybody, any company could say that, you know, you're then not standing out.
Sophie, Brian, do we place enough importance in words, or is there too much hokum, scientific hokum about the words that we use? So Gary was talking there about, you know, job adverts that talk about people being, you know, driven and energetic. And I remember reading an article before about how often words we use tend to turn off certain demographics. So if we use a lot of what are perceived of as masculine words, I'm not entirely bought into the whole masculine and feminine words, but I kind of get it. But I think it's a very broad brush statement to say there are masculine and feminine words. But like, do we spend too much time tying ourselves up in knots about the words that we use? Do we not spend enough time worrying about the words that we use? Like, cause and effect, you probably have seen it more than any of us.
Well, I would completely echo what Gary was saying around, you know, what makes your organization different and the amount of job adverts. I mean, just go, you know, go click on LinkedIn right now and read through about 5 or 6 different adverts, print them out, chop the top name off the company and the bottom name off the details, and then try and match up which company belongs to which. You'll have no idea because they'll all look exactly the same. And they will all use the exact same language that Gary was talking about: driven, self-starter, pragmatic, energetic, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Doesn't tell me anything about who you really are as a company. And again, going back to what Gary was saying, you need to take that person on a journey with your story. What do you exist for? What are you trying to achieve? And then I think the fundamental piece, because going back to your question, is I don't think we spend enough time concentrating on language. I think it's just, let's just copy and paste the advert from last time. That's generally what tends to happen. It's a copy and paste job, be a quick edit and out it goes. So language, I don't think is something we think about enough. In any human interaction, when it comes to the workplace, we don't think about language enough, but especially when it goes out externally to recruitment.
Sorry, I wonder whether you've got a view on whether, because so much more goes online now, whether that's taken some of that away. Because I think so many search on the internet that you go onto, there's several sites that are well known for recruitment, and you've just got reams and reams of adverts.
Well, let's
generally the same. It kind of takes any personality away.
It does, Lisa. It doesn't, you know, I want to, and this is where, you know, my whole cultural piece comes in here, is that, you know, I want to get a really good feel and have an identity about the organization by the words they use in their advert. Mm-hmm. And if I'm scrolling through advert upon advert upon advert, and it's the same old, almost copy and paste text. Everyone's using a very, very, it might be different words, but it's giving off the same feel. And that doesn't then make me feel like, oh, this organization is quite exciting. Or actually, I'm a very creative person and I would fit with this type of organization, even if that is what they're looking for. So I think there is a real thing about language. I think language isn't observed enough in internal interactions and external interactions. But the other thing I wanted to say, which builds upon Gary's point, is that if you look at most job adverts, I would say 90% of them will be a good, what, 4/5 of a page will be about the organisation, what they're looking for, the projects, et cetera, et cetera. And about 1/5 will be about you. What do you get from this then? So we want you to literally, you know, put your blood, sweat and tears into this organisation. We want our pound of flesh from you. We want you to achieve X, Y and Z. So you must be proficient in X, Y and Z. And then you get the bottom bit, which is, and in recompense for all your effort, you will get, and this is where your point, Ray, comes in, you will get your 28 days annual leave. You'll get a contributionary pension scheme. You'll get private healthcare, blah, blah. And that's it. And it's a one-liner. It's a one-liner about the employee's experience, and that completely needs to change, because it should be about your experience first. By working with us, you should expect that you would get, you know, development with us, decent conversations with your manager, coaching sessions, that we are a very creative organization that will give you freedom and autonomy to explore your ideas. That's the kind of advert that we should be writing about. What does the individual get as an experience? Then we talk about the organisation and what we want them to do. It shouldn't be secondary. It should be absolutely primary piece, because you're actually trying to make a sale here. You're marketing your organisation and you're trying to make a sale. You want someone to say, yeah, I want to buy that role. I want to apply for that job and I want to go work there. But we don't see it in that way. We see it that we're doing people a favour by offering the job. Yes. You should be lucky to come work for us, rather than, we want the best person to come buy this organisation. We want the best person to buy into this.
And my worry, sorry, Lisa, just to say, my worry about that is that, like, at the moment, the way the job situation is going because of COVID, companies are going to be less and less caring about how the type of person they engage, because it's an employer's market almost. Sorry, Lisa, what were you going to say?
No, I mean, yeah, I think I've only seen, and they're local companies to where we're all based, but I've only seen a couple that have ever done it slightly different through use of video, where they've almost put their recruitment advert out vocally by one of the directors or staff, and that works really well. So you've actually got staff almost doing the recruitment to say why you should want to work there and why you want to work with them, and it's a different angle of doing it, but I think you get much more of a buy-in from people looking, because you think, oh, actually I want to be there, I want to work in that building, and I want to work with that person, and I want to be sat next to them. It's sort of rather than just seeing a load of words written.
I also think organizations are missing an opportunity to if you like pre-filter and to actually look to attract more of the people that share their values and vision. And that's through their general marketing. So you actually do marketing which is sharing content over time, which tells people about what your organisation is all about and the people in it and what you do. So that in some respects, you may not even have to put out adverts, because you've got so many people actually wanting to come and work with you, specifically looking for, I'm looking for a job with this company. You know, I certainly, when I was a journalist, I was, even if there weren't jobs being advertised, I was writing to specific regional newspapers because I wanted to work with them.
Well, that's a good place to leave it for this week. We hope you enjoyed it. Please get in contact. You can email us at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. with your correspondence related to anything we've talked about in this cast. And please, we hope you'll come back and see us in part 2. We hope you enjoy it. Have a great week. Thank you very much. Don't hesitate. Rub the lamp, lad.